Welcome to Inner Life on KMUN 91.9 in Astoria, Oregon. I'm Megan McFeely, your host. My guest today is Laura Jaman Martin. She is from a suburb in St. Louis, so she's a Midwesterner. Yay, Midwest. Her ancestors were Puritans, but she grew up genetically and generically Protestant. Her working life, she's been a social worker since 1994, and now she's a lay Zen Buddhist teacher at the Great Vow Zen Monastery in Clatskanie, Oregon. I want to welcome you.
Thank you, Megan.
Yes, thanks for making the journey here. I guess I will start with your early life, because we all learn about who we are from our family, from our parents, from our community. And so you went to a fundamentalist church for many years, huh?
I did. Yeah. My dad kind of rebelled and didn't. His mother was really deeply religious and Protestant. Both sides of my family deeply Protestant. And so I grew up kind of generic Protestant, and we didn't really attend much church. So I went with some grade school friends to a pretty fundamentalist church for most of my childhood, I would say, several years of my childhood.
I did that too. Mm-hmm. I went to church with friends because my parents were intellectually oriented. Yeah. You know, they're like, well, do what you want, but it's not our thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but something happened to you when you were in sixth grade. You kind of jumped in and were game with the story and the
my mom had beliefs. She would read us Bible stories and do prayers and things, and it was the fierce God and the fear of hell God, and really lived with that fear, and went to a lot of every year vacation Bible school, and one year with the pastor in about sixth grade, as sixth graders do, they're asking the pastor, oh, if I lose my arm in my life, am I reunited with it in heaven? Things like that.
Is that what kids ask pastors?
That's what the kids in the Midwest do. What's heaven? What's that all about?
Will I get my arm back?
It's a great question, isn't it?
No, it's great. I love kids.
So somebody asked, I don't think it was me, but somebody asked, do dogs go to heaven? And the pastor said, no, no, they don't. And my dad was a veterinarian. I grew up around animals. My mom, a dog person, grandparents, same. And something deep inside me just knew that wasn't right. That wasn't quite right. And I, for whatever reason, while I could and was believing that God would banish me, a 11-year-old, to hell for doing something wrong, I somehow couldn't believe that God would do that to dogs.
Dogs. I mean, dogs.
I just couldn't. I just couldn't get with that.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah. And then there sort of opened that door. Like, well, if he's wrong about that, he'd be wrong about this whole thing.
And it started to unravel.
Started dissolving a little bit. Now I do have this foundation of Christianity, and there are such beautiful
teachings,
aspects and teachings, and that are and it is a true path for many people, and I don't diminish that at all.
I agree.
Yeah. And in fact, coming around to a Buddhist practice, that has really helped me make sense of the teachings I received in childhood that didn't ever really make sense to me before.
They're all the same.
Same for me.
And it's just the language and the culture from which they come, And I found that because I have a tradition. I follow a Sufi path. And sometimes I have to read Thomas Merton to understand what is happening in the teachings of my tradition, because he speaks to me. He's American, and he's such a grounded person. And he's, of course, a Christian monk.
Great. And he hung out with Zen people too.
He liked everyone. He wanted to learn from everyone. Isn't that beautiful? What a human being. And so then you explored other Christian or other religious traditions in order to find out what felt right to you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I went and looked into a lot of different expressions of spirituality, sort of not much, I don't think, in high school, but in my 20s, more divine feminine, nature-based kinds of things. Not much going on there in the Midwest in the 90s. So I missed the community. That is available now in a much different way these days, but back then not so much. And when I moved to Portland in 1999, around the 2000s, I would go to church. I would try out different churches and looking for some kind of spiritual home.
That was my experience too. I was working in the corporate world and my life fell apart. That's a long story. But then I was said, you know, I had known something very young about what it meant to be human in a larger scale.
Yeah.
And then it was forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, I think it happens to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But then after my, you know, this dramatic experience in my life, I was like, okay, where's the door?
Yeah.
You know, I know there's something more because I can feel it inside.
It opens you up.
It does. And so you ended up becoming a clinical social worker. Yeah. And there was some experience you had there that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
How did you take that step?
Well, I was really lucky in high school to have a brilliant high school guidance counselor who was a dear mentor and so very helpful. And he just taught us teenagers how to do what you would call Rogerian listening, listening from the Carl Rogers, who was one of the foundational therapists of the 50s and 60s, how to listen actively and offer peer counseling to each other. So I was taught those kinds of skills when I was 15 years old. And he would do, we did weekend retreats and circles of, you know, small groups led by an adult and a teen facilitator. Really beautiful. And it was there that I first experienced someone really deeply listening to me. And it really changed my life that this person and creating a container of deep listening for young people.
Can I ask how that felt? Like, what did it feel like to be deeply listened to or heard?
It was, it was transformational. It was such a relief. It was such a, it was kind of a miracle in a way. And what I realized in that experience was that I wanted to offer that to other people, that I not only could receive that, that's something I could also give. It was also, I think, an acknowledgement and a acceptance of human emotion in that setting. You know, in active listening, we're listening for emotions, we're listening for feelings, words, and reflecting that back in a deep acceptance, a field of acceptance,
which has been completely missing from our culture.
It's such a gift that we can offer each other.
Yes.
That's easily underestimated, isn't it? It's available.
You know, I'm just going to tell a quick story about what happened with me. I was very strong as a young person. I think I ran the family. And but it made me afraid because, you know, where's the boundaries?
Yeah. And who's driving the bus?
Yeah, I'm driving. I was. I've always been really strong. And but I had this experience one time with a therapist. And I was telling her about this and that, and this is how it was. And she got in my face and she said, "You do not know." And I was like, I just broke out laughing with joy.
Yeah.
Because she was the first person that said, "Here, I know more than you." Knock it off, you know?
Yeah.
It was a brilliant experience. And honestly, I don't know if it was the same, but it feels like there was just like...
Yeah, there's some...
It just this wow.
Something new
something
emerged.
Really important what happened in that moment for me. And so you became then a clinical social worker.
Yeah, I realized I just wanted to follow that path. It was always what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so grateful I've gotten to have this career.
So that easily led you to Zen Buddhism, or didn't?
I mean, it literally did.
Yes, because I don't know much about Zen Buddhism, yeah. to be honest with you. Maybe you could give us some, you know, I know you couldn't explain the whole thing.
I could easily. I mean, it's kind of funny because I learned as I was working in the Midwest, my clinical supervisor arrived from the exotic locale of Seattle with a new treatment called DBT, or dialectical behavior therapy, and she was teaching it to us. Mm. It turns out that was based in Zen Buddhism. The originator of DBT was a wow. Buddhist practitioner and a Christian, and developed this treatment based on Zen practice and Zen principles. So I was learning that. I realized that it utterly fit, because it had half of the treatment is change strategies. How do we help? How do we make a difference? But the other half is deep acceptance. Mm-hmm. And
acceptance of what? Say what the yeah, acceptance of, yeah. of what everything yeah, really
whatever is arising. Yeah. Which that wasn't always okay in the field that we were. And at that point, brief solution-focused therapy was
trying
to fix things yeah. in the fewest sessions possible, mm-hmm. have a treatment plan, and what are we solving, and mm-hmm. we're knocking down and tackling these problems mm-hmm. that you have or that you are or whatever. And there's, you know, people come because they want help, they want change. That's legit. And at the same time, to just sit with someone, to get to know them, to be with them and appreciate just who they are and how they've come to be, and that so many of these difficult maybe behaviors or patterns are there for some reason. They need to be honored because they served an important purpose at some point. They may need to be let go, they may need to be changed a little bit, but they need to be honored. And so that kind of broad welcoming of whatever's here, even just the confidence to feel into whatever's arising, that it is possible to feel our life and be okay.
I have two questions. I'm trying mm-hmm. to figure out which one to ask. Do you think that by hearing someone deeply that you changed that person? I mean, maybe it could be anyone changes that person, but mm-hmm. it actually fundamentally changes them, or the listening to another person mm-hmm. changes that person.
I like to say that in a therapeutic relationship, and really any relationship like that, where people get to hear themselves mm-hmm. talk, that mm-hmm. when you get to really listen to yourself, that's very powerful. But even what's wonderful is that the physicists and the Buddhists kind of meet in in a lot of areas. One of them
and the mystics.
Right, and the mystics, that if you observe a particle or a wave, it changes by its own, just the awareness itself when
spooky
we channel our awareness.
At a distance.
Yes,
that's what
yes,
they call
so,
it.
So that's what's, I think it's our, there's something larger than us, this attention, this awareness. It is what we are. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a recognition of that. That's inherently beneficial, inherently mm-hmm. generous, inherently healing. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it is. And so it's so interesting how, you know, psychotherapy and spiritual traditions. When I first started on my path, I saw that there was no, like in Buddhism, mm-hmm. not Zen Buddhism, because I don't really know it, but that there was no tackling of these really dark, you know, terrible, uncomfortable feelings. There was mm-hmm. no cross over between you had your path and you had your therapy. Or mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I was in Dharamshala mm-hmm. and I was watching a great man mm-hmm. talk, mm-hmm. you know, give a Dharma talk mm-hmm. or something. And a woman from New York said, "Yeah, but what do I do with all my anger?"
Yeah.
And he said, "You don't have anger."
Oh,
I mean, because no, he was uh-huh. from Tibet.
Yeah.
And they don't have the same relationship yeah. to anger in their culture as we do. Mm-hmm. And I sat there with my mouth open saying, wow, mm-hmm. you know what's going on in this room is there is not a connection mm-hmm. happening here. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there are some traditions that, like, Sufism also has a psychological element mm-hmm. to it mm-hmm. and that weaves, they can be woven together. Mm-hmm. And so is that how you feel about...
Buddhism has originated in India mm. and traveled to China, to Tibet, to Japan, and wherever it goes, it takes on the flavor of that culture.
That's true.
And then it becomes expressed differently in that culture.
That means it's alive.
It's totally alive. It's totally alive.
It's not here are the rules follow.
No. And so here's this magnificent experiment that's happening right now that it has landed in you know, North America and Europe and South America, like in these totally different places. We won't get to see the end of the story. We won't get to say, oh, well, this is the American expression of Buddhism. It's happening right now.
That's true. I didn't think of it that way. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
This is our 15-minute break. This is Inner Life on KMUN in Astoria at 91.9. I am here with Laura Jaman. Jomon, thank you. I appreciate it. Who is a lay Zen Buddhist teacher at the Great Vow Zen Monastery in Clackskanai, Oregon. And we're talking about Buddhism and Christianity. We're talking about pretty much everything. And so what was it that then moved you mm. to want to move into the monastery and become, mm. you know, to take your vows and mm. become a monk? And mm. are you still active in the world?
Yeah, I'm not a monk. I'm still a lay person. I still have a counseling practice. There are what we call monastics, people who live there full time and that's all they're doing. Or who may ordain as priests. That's another category as well. So my husband and I, we've been together a long time. We actually grew up in the same hometown, met in our 20s and have
you
had...
You didn't know each
other. We didn't know each other until we were 20. And so we've had a few incarnations of our relationship and moved to Oregon together. And our relationship was starting to fall apart. We knew we needed a spiritual connection. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just glossed over some very intense, you know, couples counseling and mm-hmm. really painful mm-hmm. moments, like real difficult time. But it clarified something important for both of us, the depth of our spiritual need and need for spiritual life in our relationship. And so we were casting about for different places and we found the monastery. Mm. I happened to be working in Columbia County and found out about it that way. And we just started practicing little by little. There's also a temple in Portland. We would go there sometimes just learning how to meditate, learning the basic principles. And we eventually decided to get married at the monastery. I didn't want to get married, but our teacher said that they're a Zen wedding is really just a affirmation of our vows for ethical behavior, basically, that we're going to support each other's spiritual practice. And I said,
I like that.
Well, I can do that. Let's do that. So we got married at the monastery, and I used to say that it felt like we married the monastery. Hmm. And it wasn't until, you know, 20 years later that we moved here, 15 years later. But just over time, we got more involved and just became embedded in the community. Mm-hmm. My husband has been the administrator of the organization for years, and we became teachers. And so it just happens to be a time for us to step forward in this way mm-hmm. and, you know, be willing to carry the monastery forward into the next iteration.
There's something so important about a Sangha, you know. And a Sangha means a group community. Yeah. I also had that in California. Mm. And my husband is also part of my tradition. And so the way in which the Sufis are about love, you know, like there is this intense feeling in my heart of love. It's present. I can just go into it and it's very intense. And that is the how we connect, mm-hmm. my husband and mm-hmm. I, is through mm-hmm. that intense love, mm-hmm. even though our personalities could be no more opposite. Like, we honestly, the only thing that we actually do that we both like is we like the same coffee, and that's it. No, literally, it's so, you just, he knows what I'm going to think because it's the opposite of what he thinks.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he's an engineer.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So, but that basis mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is the thing that keeps you grinding. Yeah. I mean, in Sufism, sometimes they say you need a partnership to grind down all the edges.
Your sharp edges.
The edges of, you know, what you think is important uh-huh. and who you think you are and what you think they should be. Yeah. And it's really an incredible crucible.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Real people and living in a community. Even more so, it's like a sack of rocks.
No, I can only handle this. I could not. I mean, living in a community, everybody thinks it's great bliss. The angels are there.
Yeah, no, it turns out it's people.
Yeah.
But we at least are endeavoring to face the same direction.
That's beautiful.
We're at least trying to be on the same page. We're, you know, willing to come around and repair when needed. And I mean, that's,
you know, one of the things I think is incredibly important is learning to take responsibility for oneself and your reactions mm-hmm. and your feelings and mm-hmm. understanding where they come from. Mm-hmm. And you got to have a lot of tools to do this mm-hmm. work, you know, mm-hmm. and you have to have a big commitment to it. Yeah. So, but I came here for it. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I've been driving full hearts, you know, hard stop for towards freedom.
Yeah.
Even as a child. Yeah. Was that your experience too?
I think that, what made sense to me and what makes sense to me is this, the continuous thread, I think, has been the wish to relieve suffering, mm-hmm. and whatever form that has taken, whether it's my suffering or someone else's. Like,
I was in it to release my own suffering.
Absolutely, that is legit. That's how we all got here. Nobody shows up to a Zen Buddhist meditation class because everything's going so awesome.
No,
think I'll just sit with myself for 40 minutes. That sounds fun. No.
No, let's talk about that because I have sat in a silent retreat in a Buddhist community mm-hmm. and I thought I was going to rip my face off. It was so, I couldn't believe it's what really was going hard. On in my mind and how much, you know, anger and everything that was coming up. It's incredible. People don't know how hard it is to meditate.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. And so it's important to have a teacher. It's important to, I mean, the apps are great. They're helpful. Yeah. They can take you to a point.
Yeah.
But unless you've been in an actual room with other humans and had some instruction, especially posture instruction from another human
and breathing.
Being, breathing, you know, all those things, there are tricks to make it doable mm-hmm. and ways to work with that material that just erupts, you know, or the restlessness or all of those things that there's not a meditator, you know, these adept teachers or masters, they all went through the same thing.
Yeah.
There's no way around it, but there are ways to work with it when it comes up.
One time we were at a retreat for my community and somebody raises their hand and says, to my teacher, I have a hard time meditating. And he said, does anyone else? And we all just busted out laughing.
That's brilliant.
Because it's just essentially every single person. Of course, I've been doing this 15 years and I still can't meditate.
Uh-huh.
And that is the truth of it. You just have to keep directing yourself. Yeah. It's a practice.
And it really, you know, if we let go of some idea of what we think it should be mm-hmm. and open to whatever's coming up, the sensations, emotions, thoughts, just observing them.
So when you say open to whatever's coming up, mm-hmm. is it a physical, like you can have a real physical responses to things that are coming up for yourself?
Sure. I mean, we can, one way to think about it is to just direct our attention. Like you can feel your hands right now and that simplifies things. If we can just return, have a little anchor point that feels safe, that feels okay. Mm. Yeah, I can feel my hands, or, you know, for a lot of practices, it's the breath or things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, our mind will start singing a song or telling a terrible story, or there might be some emotional thing that arises. And that's not to be erased or cut out, or, you know, we can just acknowledge it. Yeah. Yeah, just acknowledge this is what's happening. I'll do my best to return to the practice. Or again, this, it's important for it to take place in the context of a teacher or community. Those are the ideally,
yeah.
To have an actual live person to bounce those experiences off of.
So what is the relationship that Buddhism has to trauma? Mm-hmm. Like, see, my experience with Buddhism was that there's no place for emotional, the deep woundings of childhood or whatever, that there's no real place for it there. Mm-hmm. But see, in sitting with my own deep wounds, just my attention there and the feeling, allowing myself to feel it, yep. You know, physically, I'd sweat, I'd cry, you know, many things you'd do. This is really going into some stuff, true. Isn't it? Yeah. But is that similar to what happens in a in the Zen tradition?
I mean, in our meditation, there is this field of just benevolent acceptance, and of course things arise. We would call that karma. You know, the things that have happened, the things that have happened before we were even born, certainly affect us and are here and present, or the habits we have accumulated, whether that is, you know, gripping and protecting, which again had its place at some time, was important at some time, that, you know, as we pay attention to things, they change. And we may find a little more spaciousness. We may find a little more room to, or see something from a slightly different perspective, and thus it changes. We might have a little more room for our life and our karma to be able to see it in a different light.
So, what was your biggest challenge in learning how to meditate, and what kept coming up for you? Because this is really about your. Your path and your willingness to share with us is great.
But I really hated meditating at first.
Yeah.
I really hated it.
Yeah.
I went to a meditation retreat and just was sure I was doing it wrong. I think perfectionism is probably the killer for a lot of people, or just carrying some idea of what it ought to be, or just a habit of belief that whatever I'm doing isn't good enough. So that whatever our habits are, we will carry them into our meditation. Like, they will show up. Meditation is a blank slate. And so whatever our thing is, it will show up. So I think a habit of inner criticism, a habit of perfectionism, a habit of holding myself really tightly, that guess what? Here it is.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. I really want to thank Jomin Martin, who is a lay Zen Buddhist teacher at the Great Vow Monastery in Klakskanai. I hope you can join us here on 91.9 every third Monday at 9:30. Thanks for being here.